This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is pianist Marion McPartland's 80th birthday. She's celebrating with a concert at New York's Town Hall tomorrow night that will be broadcast live on many NPR stations. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with McPartland, recorded in 1987. She's not only a great pianist, she's brought us interviews with and performances by great pianists in her NPR series, Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz, which has been running nearly 20 years. Let's hear a brief excerpt of her show with Bill Evans.
I guess probably because I meet so many young pianists, I haven't the faintest idea how to get from one key to another. Oh. Now, see, from F to A flat isn't bad, but suppose you were going to go from, say you had to go from F to B, how would you go?
Well, I don't know, but you know, we used to have to do that, right? I mean, on jobs, you know, you just the guy.
Did you ever play club dates?
Did I
weddings?
Ever play?
Well, I don't
kidding.
Know. Did you?
You gotta be kidding. Of course.
Bar mitzvahs, did you?
For how many years?
I honestly didn't know you did because I did. I played a lot of them. Actually, I had some pretty good people there. Roy Eldridge used to play these things.
Well,
with
you're
me.
Lucky. I mean, I played with. You know, I was just saying the other day that something took me back. We started playing a polka during the record date, just kidding around. Toots got into a polka. I said it took me back to the Manville Polish home where I used to play with a great polka band. Man, the leader was a drummer who sat on a riser so high that it looked like you were looking straight up at him when you were in the bandstand. And he played with one hand and held a microphone in the other and say he knew thousands of polkas in Polish. But I mean, there's just one example. I used to go there, used to have to take a train, go to Manville, play the job for 4 hours. You used to play 2 hours, get a half hour break, and play an hour and a half. And I think I made $4 or maybe $5. Of course, this was in the 40s. But I played all the jobs and the weddings. And then when I came to New York, even when I had started to record already, had won the New Jazz Critics Poll, you know, New Talent, mm-hmm. whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
All of that,
sure.
I still had my tuxedo, you know, regularly cleaned and pressed,
yeah.
And was playing a friendship club in Brooklyn 3 nights a week in Roseland and all of the kind of, you know, society gigs.
Let's do another tune.
Yeah, okay.
How about a thing you were noodling with before?
The ballad?
This is all I ask.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
Who wrote that? I'm trying to think.
Gordon Jenkins. Yeah, I just recorded it last week with for my next Warner's album with Toots Thielemans.
This is all I ask.
This is all I ask.
From a 1979 edition of her Piano Jazz series. McPartland is one of the few women instrumentalists of her generation who made it in the world of jazz. She grew up in England and moved to America after marrying Chicago cornetist Jimmy McPartland. They met during World War II while they were each performing for the troops. For the first few years of her 20-year marriage, she played Dixieland standards with her husband, but since the early 50s, she's led her own small groups playing more modern music. Jimmy McPartland died in March of 1991, a month after he and Marion remarried. Here's our 1987 interview with Marion McPartland.
I'd like to talk with you about your life. So many of your listeners on radio have heard you talk with other musicians about their lives. I want to hear some about yours. I know you came from a pretty proper family in England. Your mother mm-hmm. played classical music and I think wished that you played classical music too. They didn't like the idea of you playing jazz. What did it represent to your parents?
I don't think they minded. I don't think they minded what I played. It was just when they got the idea that I was going to do something in music that they weren't going to see me get what they thought would be a nice job. Like my father always thought it would be nice if I worked in a bank or became a nurse, of all ridiculous things. And they really didn't mind me playing jazz, but when they finally got the word that I was going to be in it, then it became a different thing, music as a profession.
What did they object to about that?
Oh, just the idea of oh, I think my mother said, what was it? Oh, you'll come to no good. You'll marry a musician and live in an attic. See, that's pretty much what happened. Although we weren't ever in the attic, but we were in some funny little apartments. But that was her idea, that I would meet terrible people and that I would come to no good, you know, that it would represent something depraved.
Did your teachers in music school feel the same way?
When I finally studied, the 3 years that I did take lessons at the Guildhall School of Music, I played by ear up until that time. When I was studying, the professor I had there was a very wonderful guy, very solemn, but very much against jazz. And at that time, I was really into learning all kinds of jazz from records. And I would be supposed to be practicing, but I would be playing something by Art Tatum or trying to perfect an Art Tatum run or something. And he opened the door one time and said, got very red in the face, "Stop playing that trash!" So I'm afraid there's probably still a few people that feel that way, but not as much as they did at that time. But it really wasn't long after that that I left and took off with a four-piano act. That was my first introduction to not so much the jazz life, but the show business life. And actually, now I'm rather proud of having worked in all those vaudeville theaters, because they're very historical places, those of them that are still standing.
Probably gave you some stage confidence also.
Well, yes, and how to act and talk on a microphone, although doing the piano show helped a lot more.
I think your entry into the jazz life came during World War II, when you were playing for the troops and playing a lot of jazz. Were you considered something of a freak, being a woman jazz musician?
No, I don't think so, Terry. Because when I went to France and played in a group for the armed forces, that really wasn't jazz. That was sort of showbiz again. And then, actually, after I met Jimmy, I guess that's when I feel that I really got into playing a little more actual jazz. But then, when I came here to the States and got to hear all the people in person that I had loved for so long on records, like Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Teddy Wilson, all those people, then a lot of it did start to sort of rub off on me, and I became a better player because of hearing all these people, and of course because of Jimmy, working with his group.
Well, when you started playing, you were playing with your husband's band.
Yes.
And I wonder if it was hard for you to get your own sense of identity as a performer. I think a lot of women who are married to someone who they work with, especially a few decades ago, were considered the wife of, and kind of secondary to, the man who was performing. Did that ever happen?
Funny. I guess I must have been naturally pushy or something. Plus the fact that Jimmy was very helpful. He was always very helpful and very admiring of my talent, and he was always kind of introducing me to do solo numbers and to do numbers with the band. He seemed to be very proud of what I did. In fact, when we moved to New York, it was really through Jimmy that I got started with the trio, because I really didn't want to. He kept saying, "Oh, you ought to have your own trio, and you shouldn't be working in this band." I could feel myself getting out of the Dixieland chord structure and into more modern things. And of course, I listened to everything that was going on all the time. So he really was the one that kind of sold me on the idea that I should have my own trio. And once I did start with the trio, Jimmy was very helpful in introducing me to all kinds of people. And I always tell him he created a monster because, you know, once I started, I didn't want to stop. That was it.
Well, some jazz musicians remain sidemen all their lives. They spend their lives playing with other people's bands.
That's true.
Very early on in your career, you became a leader. How did you manage to pull that off?
Well, working with Jimmy is sort of, I mean, working with your own husband, I mean, it in many ways, it was a very comfortable situation. And starting with the trio, I guess what happened was that I got booked in this one place, the Embers, and so since I had been booked as the leader, I was able to hire the people to work with me, and from then on, it always was that way. I was always booked and as the leader, and would hire the best. I always wanted the best sidemen there were available. As a matter of fact, in a way, I'm kind of sorry that I didn't, what I would call, go through the ranks and be a sideman or side person with some other groups. But it just didn't work out that way, because I went right from working with Jimmy to my own trio. And it was very hard, because it was a top club, and I felt that I was very green and callow, and it's funny, I couldn't open my mouth. I remember we had my group, and Eddie Haywood was opposite me, and I couldn't even think what to say to introduce him. I had it written on a piece of paper. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and now I'd like to introduce Eddie Haywood. You know, I would do it, and I would be shaking. It was so funny. But, you know, we went, I guess you learn by doing, you know.
Jimmy McPartland used to drink a lot.
Yes, he sure did.
Did you ever feel, since you were his wife, when you were playing together on the bandstand, that you had to keep one eye on how much he was drinking?
Oh, Terry, that's a whole other... I mean, if you ever want to do a show on alcoholism and AA, I could talk about that. I mean, Jimmy finally went into AA, and I was probably a terrible person, because I was always nagging and worrying about that. It just seems like there's always somebody around, a person who drinks a lot. There's always some sort of well-meaning do-gooder trying to keep them straight, and that was me.
Well, that must have put a real strain on your performing, to on the one hand be playing, and on the other hand trying to keep track of what was happening with your husband.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many anecdotes I could tell about that. At this point, they seem funny, though at the time they weren't, because, you know, when somebody's drinking, they always have a million friends who want to make sure that they buy them drinks and they get their quota. You know, Jimmy would walk around the bar and tell everybody that his wife couldn't stand to see him drink, and so his friends would say, oh, that's terrible. You know, they would carry a water glass full of gin into the men's room, and I never could figure out how he got... Although Jimmy wasn't a sort of a falling down drunk, he just got very slow and boring, you know. And the worst thing that would happen would be he'd be announcing a tune, and it would take him 10 minutes to announce the tune, and we'd all be saying, "Oh, for God's sake, get on with it," you know. No, that's a whole other side of my life, and it seems to have, in retrospect, as I say, a lot of it seems very funny, though at the time it was quite a tragedy. But it's great; it worked out, because he did stop, and he has a very healthy life. He's a very healthy person, and so many of the musicians that he worked with are gone, probably because of that. You know, a lot of people died too young.
We're featuring a 1987 interview with pianist Marion McPartland. Jimmy McPartland died 4 years after our conversation was recorded. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with more of our 1987 interview with pianist Marion McPartland. Today's her 80th birthday.
You told us a little earlier that you didn't feel that out of place being a woman early on in your jazz career, and I'll tell you, I find that hard to believe.
Well, you see, Terry, before I had gone to America, there were so many women that I had listened to who were my idols, like Hazel Scott, Mary Lou Williams, Lil Armstrong, and a woman who I've really admired a great deal, Cleo Brown, so that I didn't realize that being a woman, when I got to New York, being a woman with a jazz group, people would find it unusual, because it seemed to me that there were plenty of women out there, and I still think so.
You know what might have been helpful to you, too, being married to a jazz musician? And what I mean by that is that you weren't, quote, available to any man who thinks, well, I think I'll flirt with that dame pianist, you know, because
No, that's true. That's true.
You know,
and then there's this to it also, Terry, that when I did get out with my own trio, I was really in it for the music. Like, although I think I dressed pretty well, you know, cared about my appearance. There wasn't any idea of, well, I'm going to play and I'm going to be winking at some guy at the bar. I was always, I wanted so much for the music to be accepted, and I really wanted to play as well as I could, and that's always been in the forefront, you know, to try to play as well as I could. Although at that time I think I was rather dependent upon the opinion of other people. I mean, I'm not so much that anymore. I've sort of become my own person a little more than I was then.
You know, women singers have always been accepted more than women instrumentalists.
Oh, definitely. That's a whole other breed. Yeah, singers. I don't know why that is. Well, because every band had the girl singer. And, you know, that's a whole other story. I don't even want to get into that. I would hate to have been a girl singer because I feel that you're really fair game then when you're traveling on with a busload of guys. And that must have been awfully hard.
And you had to dress more sexy, too.
Oh, sure.
Low-cut gowns and things like that when you were the quote girl singer. You've, as a musician, had to be on the road a lot during your life. You've been lucky enough to have very long stays at certain clubs, like the Cafe Carlisle in New York and the Hickory House in New York. But I think life on the road is the downfall of a lot of performers, and it's in part how they end up on drugs or alcohol. Was it hard to not give in to temptations like that, especially probably with some of the, not peer pressure exactly, but when you're hanging out with people and everybody's going drinking after the set, you know?
Oh, I had my share of drinks, but I never, I always had that feeling about, like, years ago when we used to be hanging out in pubs in England, it was always, you know, you're supposed to be able to drink and hold it. You're not supposed to get drunk. You know, it's sort of undignified and terrible, undignified thing to do. So I could never, ever see myself getting out of control. I mean, I used to like to have drinks at the Hickory House. In fact, I used to like to pour a straight shot when nobody was looking. I thought I was really getting back at the owner. I would get one of the bottles. You know, we were surrounded by bottles on the bandstand, and when nobody was looking, I would pour myself a shot and drink it, you know, and sort of one up for me. But as far as pot or any of the other things, I wouldn't do that to myself. I mean, I did smoke a little pot, but just once or twice, but it never affected me in a good way. And a bass player once said to me, "Oh, but Marion, you really have to learn how to handle that. You have to get used to being able to handle it." I said, "Well, if I have to do that, then I don't want to do it." And I've never done anything that would get in the way of playing, although I can see how that would be a hang-up for some people, because I think one has that feeling of wanting to be on top and be the best you can possibly be every night, and that if you take something that's going to help you be that way, temptation is to be wanting to do that every night.
You know, your career has had an interesting graph to it. A lot of musicians start their careers, well, early on in their lives, become very well known for a certain style, for a certain recording, and then they reach a peak early on, and it's kind of, in the public eye, it's kind of downhill from there. And I think with your career, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been this slow upward.
It's amazing.
Rising. Every year you become better known, and I think your playing becomes more beautiful. And it's I think it's an unusual twist on the typical career.
It's funny. I think, well, I just feel as if everything I've done has been a sort of a springboard to do something else, and I like to set goals for myself and always have something new to do. And I also have this feeling that one, you're supposed to improve as you learn more, that you're supposed to get better. I feel as if I know more, I should therefore be able to play more, and I'm always trying to eliminate bad things about my playing. And it's just that feeling, I think, well, you should be able to do better, you should be able to play better, you should be able to write more. And so far, I've been lucky. That's the way it's gone.
This also brings to mind a very nice quote from Mary Lou Williams that's in one of the profiles in your new book. And she says, anything you are shows up in your music.
Yeah, isn't that a great thing?
I do like that quote a lot. It seems to me that cuts both ways, though.
probably
the wisdom of your life is reflected in your music. But if you're really in a real rut emotionally, that could come out in your music, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it could. I mean, I don't want to drop any names, but I can think of some people years ago that I felt that about, that they would reach a certain level. And I guess the temptation is, if you're very well known, is to reach a certain level and then coast on what you had. And you sort of think, well, I don't have to do any better. But I think maybe that's the way I've always been brought up, that you're supposed to always do your best and try hard and don't give up. And there's this saying about, I forget who said this, but that when you sit down to play, you should play as if it were the last day of your life. Play as well as you can, because it may be the last chance you have to play. And I think a lot of us do feel that way.
I thank you very much.
Are we done?
The time just flew by. Thank you so much for being here, Marianne McPartland.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Marianne McPartland recorded in 1987. Today is her 80th birthday. She celebrates with a concert tomorrow night, which will be broadcast live from Town Hall on many NPR stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Happy birthday, Marianne.